It's March 24th, 2015, and this interview is taking place at Academy Drive in Thunder Bay. And I'll have the person that we are interviewing today introduce himself and his current position.
Okay, my name is Jeff Halverson, and I'm currently the general manager at Duchok Scrap Metal Limited.
Great, and you're also a member of the Friends of Grain Elevators
Yes.
Group, and we have talked in the past about how Scrap Metal Dealer is even remotely involved with our elevator project.
Yes.
And I know the interview is not going to be a long one, but I would like to have on record some of the issues that that you're familiar with once elevators are decommissioned. So maybe just first of all, are you a Thunder Bay person?
Yes, I moved here when I was 11.
11,
from British Columbia. so I've been here since I was 11, went to high school here, went to post-secondary education here, and have since worked here in the city. So for all intents and purposes, I'm more of a local chap, mm-hmm. you could say.
Okay. And what was your first exposure to the grain elevators?
The first time I remember ever thinking about grain elevators or looking at grain elevators, my father and I were trying to cross the bridge that's right beside TBT Engineering, the Mission Bridge that goes to Mission. And I remember a Patterson ship going through that bridge, or a ship going through that bridge, and then looking down the river and seeing the elevators. That is my earliest experience. That I would have been, I would have been 12 or 13 years old at the time, just after I'd come to Thunder Bay. And that was my first experience with the elevators. I fell in love with them shortly thereafter. I mean, this was way back to when my father bought a truck out in Saskatchewan and we went across the prairies. And that was kind of neat because a lot of people just say it's a flat drive. And I really enjoyed looking at all the older elevators, the wooden ones and all the different kind that are out there. And really got enthralled with how many Thunder Bay has, especially as I began to look at some of the different sizes that we have here, the different companies that are represented here, and how they're very large conglomerates, often around the world. And that was a big deal for me. So got a little bit more interested in that and what was happening. And I had a love of ships. I love trains. Everything is interconnected. And so it just made sense that as I looked a little more into trains and ships and just, you know, more of a hobby type thing, elevators just naturally fell into that category as well.
What? How have you been inside an elevator?
Yes, I was inside the Great Western Grain Byproducts. I was in that one, and I have been in the bowels only, the bottom area of Vitura Terminal B. When we actually had a salty come to Thunder Bay late last year, and the crew had scrap metal on their ship. It was the Federal Matawa, I believe it was, and the crew came from somewhere overseas, and they had a whole bunch of scrap metal pins from some of the big opening doors on some of the bins of the ship, electric motors, things of that nature, and so they pushed it all over from Vitura Terminal A in a shopping cart over to our facility. And then when I realized where they were coming from and where they had been, I actually got a call on the phone from the captain, who asked if we'd like to come over there and pick some more of it up. And I said, sure. So over we went, and we watched these guys take it all off the ships. And that was Vitura Terminal B, I believe they were parked beside. And they had to drag it all the way down from all along the dock, all the way to the very edge of the elevator. And then we picked it up from there because I got tired of seeing these guys pulling shopping carts full of, there's a lot of tracks over there, as you know. And they said that one guy complained that the trolley he was using didn't work very well for the terrain that he was on. And I says, well, it's because you're in the middle of a whole bunch of railroad tracks and a yard that isn't quite graded or plowed and the road's in bad condition there. So he was very disappointed. There was two guys pushing the shopping cart, one guy pulling it with a rope, and another guy trying to give directions as to how they should maneuver the road. So it was quite interesting.
Now, did you say where the ship was from?
The Federal Matawa, I believe it was. Now, I believe the crew came from somewhere in India.
Okay.
That's where the crew was from. And they, I guess, go out on these ships for months at a time, and they take their families with them. And so when the crew decided that they needed to relax from being on the ship, which was often after they came and delivered scrap metal because they received money for that, they had heard from other crew members that Intercity Shopping Mall was a favorite place to be. And so I was persuaded to give all of the workers a ride. And then the next day that they brought scrap, they asked specifically for me. I'd been nice to them because I enjoyed the ships and thought it was really neat that they were here. They asked me to go back and pick up some of their friends from the ship. And so when I got there was ladies, little children, babies, everybody. And they piled into the back of a one ton, and we literally, it was open air in the back of a one ton with sides on the one ton, and we all drove to Intercity. And we pulled up in front of the doors, and everyone piled out of the back, and they all looked like they had come straight. Many of them were in white coveralls, something you'd expect to see when they were going in to do something that was nuclear reactive or something similar. So I can't imagine what people must have thought as these guys all piled out of the back, charged into the mall, and I just drove away. I'm pretty sure that there was something that was probably said or done, or maybe even somebody that was called, but they all seemed to have a great time. They came again for a third day in a row with some more stuff. They had trouble getting their ship loaded. They had delays. And so they had, on their way to the mall, spotted the Old Navy at the Thunder Center and went and blew their next earnings at Old Navy on clothes. And that was a big, huge deal to them. So.
Now, where would they have gathered all of this scrap from? Like, was
This
it
is.
just old stuff off the ship,
This is
or?
stock that seemed to have become obsolete and repairs they had made. They had, I know that part of their, aside from the captain, who's apparently one half of the navigation, the other equal on the ship appeared to be the chief engineer, who made it very clear that he was the captain's equivalent on the ship side. He called it the navigation side and the ship side. And he was the ship side, and the captain was the navigation side. And on the ship side, he was responsible for repairing that needed to be repaired, fixing, fabricating. All of that is on the ship, so it's self-sufficient. They can do it when they go to ports, but often they have to do it out at sea, especially for salties that are out on open water for long periods of time. So they had all kinds of stuff that had gone and had made it into a corner of the ship and had never gotten off. And I guess at a lot of ports, they're not near a scrapyard. So they had no idea how to go about ever getting it off port. One guy had confessed that he was dangerously close to just throwing it all in the ocean. He said he would just get rid of it, and that way no one would know everywhere it went. It was just steel. I mean, he said, there's probably lots of steel in the ocean. I said, you're probably right, there is. But he thought if you can get some money for it, and they collected it and collected it and collected it until such time as they found a port that had a yard that was very close. So when they departed about a week or so later, he called me and said he was going to tell all his shipping buddies about Dewchuck Scrap Metal in Thunder Bay, and then anytime a ship came to Thunder Bay to go to Dewchuck's with scrap, I said, "Oh, great!" So next year, that'll be this coming year, coming up this shipping season. We'll see how many federal somethings come in with, because we have a lot of federal salties that start with the word federal, and they're all from different plots. And we'll see how many come for scrap, and from where these people come from. That was just one ship, so it should be interesting.
Now, you might also suggest to them that they rent a half ton for a half day.
Yes, that might be a little easier, but yes, that trolley, as they called it, the shopping cart, was that was quite something to see. And they had upwards of 400 pounds in this stupid shopping cart.
So what kind of money would they have made on something like that?
Well, metals that we take, whether ferrous, which is magnetic steel, and non-ferrous, aluminums, brass, coppers, all that kind of stuff, it's all tied to commodities and it's tied to the stock market. So with oil taking a bit of a dive as it is currently now, it's down a little bit, but they also go up. Last year when those guys came in, it was the fall time, metals were very good. I think they walked out with anywhere from $200 to $300 each time that they came in. So not a significant amount, but over the course of 3 or 4 days, they probably earned in upwards of 1,000, which I guess they managed to use as a bit of a slush fund. They were able to blow that money, as opposed to having to put it back into a ship budget or something of that nature. It seemed like it was their tip thing to deal with, so they could buy
Almost
a lot of money.
like collecting pop cans.
Almost like collecting pop cans. These guys have been collecting steel, And yes, and so these, like I say, they were from India, and apparently in India they didn't have some of these stores, they said. And I was, like I said, it was quite an interesting experience to get into that culture a little bit, to really talk to these people about how they worked, and being away, some of them were away from their families. The weirdest comment I got, and I can say it on tape because obviously I don't know the man from a hole in the ground. He's probably on the other side of the world right now. Is he looked at a pair of large steel bolts. These things were quite large. They were probably about 3 feet long and about 6 inches in diameter, and they were large tubular looking things, and they were apparently the bolts that helped hold the gates on top of the large units in the ship. And he commented to me and asked me if I thought that they looked like missiles. And I said, well, that wasn't my first thought, but now that you mention it, they kind of do look like missiles. So I thought, okay, that's not the first thing, but I guess, something like that, it's just a different perception, right? He commented that he thought they were missiles for sure. And I said, okay, well, we'll go with that, but we don't accept those, so try to keep those on the ship, and we'll just take all the steel and everything else. So interesting, different cultures.
Now, for historical purposes, describe where Duchak's is in relation to the grain
We
elevators.
are literally a stone's throw away from what was previously the P&H elevator. Right next to it sits what used to be Agricor United, S House, and beyond that, UGG, and then we are right next to that is Vitura A and B. I believe A is still one of the largest in Canada or the world. I'm not sure, but I know it's a large elevator. So we are directly. There is a row of elevators right alongside of us, literally right next door to us. There is nothing between us and the elevators, and nothing between the elevators and the Lake Superior. So we see all the ships come in and out, and not easily. The three elevators that we can see easiest are actually the three that are currently down in that little section: the P&H elevator, the UGG, and the Agricor S House. And oddly enough, my neighbor, was the electrician at P&H, so I got a lot of background information about what's going on there. As that elevator has recently become decommissioned, what's been taken out, what's been there, and I've seen the recoverable material start to come into our space as well, because that is now owned by Global Recycling, which is currently in the old Manitoba Pool elevator. So it's all very, we're working closely with all of them, and with the fact that they have that elevator or are working in that elevator. I see a lot, and I talk to my neighbor as well, so I hear again about what he took out and some of the issues he had with a century-old elevator and the
And what
differences.
is that person's name?
My neighbor, that would be Wayne, would be his first name, and I'm not sure of his last name.
Okay.
But
Because he
Wayne.
might be a good person to speak to.
Yes, and he was the electrician there for many, many, many years. And like he said, it was a duct tape of an elevator, all held together by different pieces of this or that, the old P&H elevator. But he made it work, so he'd probably have a lot of interesting stories about what he had to do to keep it going.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that we've interviewed an electrician. So, could you
Yes.
make contact with him?
Sure.
Maybe track down
Yeah, you know
his.
what I could do is I could talk to Wayne and indicate that I had been chatting with you about this, and see, I got to go over to him anyway to talk about a different issue there. So I could talk to him and see if he's interested. He doesn't say a lot, and he's
Yeah,
doesn't say a whole lot, but
just mention to him that
I could put you in contact, or at least
yeah, that is just his story. It's not a
yes,
test.
right, yes. No, I could make contact and see if he's
Sure.
interested,
Yeah,
if that's
thank you.
okay. Yeah.
Appreciate that. Now, what kinds of things are, you've mentioned the metal salvageable from elevators, but it's also not very easy to, a lot of the stuff is not very easy to get out.
No,
So
no.
what kinds of things are salvaged from the elevators, especially since you know, oh, this
Yes.
came from an elevator.
Yes. What are salvageable from elevators that we see most often is a lot of pyro, which is explosion proof or fire retardant. So it's copper tubing, but it's filled with a white powder with little conduits in the center, and it's basically blast proof. I guess with grain dust, it's one of those things where you have to have a lot of blast proof tubing and or wiring, according to my boss. And so we see a lot of that. We see a lot of aluminum conduit, which holds wire inside of it that goes to various areas. We see a lot of big electric motors. Those are vital for every aspect of that elevator. And we see a lot of those. We see transformers, big transformers. There's so much electrical side stuff that goes on in an elevator that it ends up being a lot of like aluminum conduit for wires, a lot of tech cable, small tech cable, medium and large tech cable, which is basically three conductor wire. And then the aluminum side of it, which is the conduit. And I've seen everything from old shovels to if people can, whatever they can find, they'll grab. And then the steel side, old everything from rail pins to shackles and little hooks that would be a shelving that come off walls. Anything they can find that isn't affixed to a wall normally is taken off first. Rebar, a lot of reinforced things like that. So they'll get rebar if they can, if it's accessible. Often not, but there could be stocks of it somewhere. And that's about it. So it's a lot of high value copper. There are brass connections and things like that as well. So we'll see brass, we'll see copper. We will see a lot of transformers and electric motors, and then we'll see some aluminums, some basic aluminums.
Now, what are the more valuable? What are the most valuable things?
Copper and brass by far, not even close. Whereas aluminum, you might get anywhere from 55 to 65 cents a pound. Copper, you can get anywhere from $2.50 to $3 a pound. Mm-hmm. So copper is where it's at. It's what people will risk their lives, more or less, to get. You see, copper also has to be strung to whatever it's at, light fixtures, belts that are going back and forth on the top of the elevator, and people will very nicely chop off what they can reach to hand height, but beyond there it becomes a game of life and death when guys are scaling walls, you know, crooked ladders, whatever they got to do to get higher up to get this wire that's either fastened along the side of the wall or hooked through little brackets or whatever. It's not easy to get off, it's hard, but it's definitely very valuable, and it's everywhere.
Now, is most of the salvaging that's done at the elevators, is most of it done by reputable salvagers?
I would say that.
Do you know the difference, like from your side in receiving this stuff?
I do. Like, for instance, if someone, like again, if someone like a, it's public knowledge that say Global Recycling owns P&H. So we'll see the P&H. We'll see Global come in with tech cable from P&H elevator. That's reputable recyclers. They're salvagers. That's their job. Their job is to work on taking part of that elevator down or all of it. And so, yes, I can tell reputable because we know, Thunder Bay is a big, small town. You know the demolition people that are supposed to be doing that. Non-reputable salvagers are usually in there before the reputable ones even get in there. Non-reputable salvagers are peddlers, we call them. Who end up just running in there, knowing that it's no longer working, and will strip bare whatever they can find, and using any sort of crude tools that they can. They're the ones who often employ tactics where, geez, I hope that the power has been cut to this line. And if it hasn't, well, I'm going to find out when I cut it, right? And it's dangerous. The people that are unproven are often without homes, vehicles, money. They are just trying to get their next meal and or whatever else they determine is the most important thing to buy with whatever money they can get. They will do almost anything for it. And they're hard to catch. They do it at middle of the night. Elevators, lots of place to hide. And you're not going to get a lot of law enforcement crawling through there trying to find someone trying to grab a piece of tech cable. Even if you can say it was from there, it's hard to catch them in the act. Very, very difficult. They don't go in there with trucks and machines. There's just somebody in there, right? And you don't know, and then all of a sudden they sneak out, and you haven't seen them, and that's it. Unless there's working camera systems and or a security house like some of the other elevators have, if it's not staffed, you'd never know who's in there and who's not. You can close all the doors and bolt them, but, I mean, there's other ways to get into an elevator. So it's, yes, I'd say a large portion of it is non-reputable. In some cases, it may even be reputable, but we call non-reputable anything other than the companies that are contracted to demolish the elevator. Everybody else is considered non-reputable. There's very little we can do. Very seldom is it ever reported. Often because when an elevator is decommissioned, a lot of the best and most prized components are taken out by the elevator company itself and is shipped to another elevator. For instance, with P&H, a lot of it, according to the electrician, went across town to Cargill. a lot of the motors that were working, some of the, you know, he had stocks of tech cable, stuff that wasn't on the wall, just stocks, reserves. That stuff doesn't sit in the elevator when it's gone. That stuff goes to a working elevator or to somebody's supply haven. What's left is just the stuff that's fixtured to the wall, bolted to walls, inside, you know, channels and irons and things like this that are very, very difficult to get. So a lot of the easy stuff is gone. Often it's salvaged in a very reputable way by the company or the new company that gets in there immediately, but the peddlers will take whatever else they can find. And that can be extensive. That's a huge issue with decommissioned elevators and why it's not so easy to just get them up and running again in a couple of years. Is you can go in there, you know, the heat's gone, everything's gone. So if you have, it's one thing to take away all the supplies and stocks, but say that I've left in place fire suppression systems, all these things that you need in an elevator for it to become up and running again. If you take away all the tech cable and everything freezes and you cut power to all the things that need power, to rewire an elevator is quite something different than going and flipping on a switch. So that's why I guess when there's been certain elevators that have been down, they've tried to be guarded, I guess, at some point in time to try to maintain their value. Whereas ones that aren't, very very soon they become infested with both people, wildlife. It all adds to the cost of trying to restructure it or rebirth it, get it going again if ever that were the case. So yes, they may make their money, but they do a lot of damage. They put themselves in danger. There's very little we can do about it. We buy from people unless we can prove that it's been from there. And again, even if it says P&H on it, there's nothing that I can do to say that this person didn't get it from somebody that works there, that he didn't go and was hired on behalf of that company. What we do is, as part of our scrap repair policies, everybody that brings stuff in we have to scan their driver's license. So all of the information about that person is on file. If they don't have a driver's license and they can't give us ID, we cannot buy from them. That is a city bylaw. So there's no reason why somebody like the recycling company can't come in and say, look, I just lost 50,000 or 500 pounds of tech cable. And I'll say, oh, was it this stuff here? Yes, that's what it was. Okay, we have camera system. When did that come in? We've got cameras on the scale. We can see who it was. Often you can't get a good description from the people that you see. They got a hood on or whatever. Their ID will be on file. Now, is it their ID? I don't know that either. Often, again, it's two people come in a van. And the person that's doing the deed and cashing it in, they'll have the other person in the van on record, and that person has nothing to do with the person in the van. They've obviously, for every measure we'll put in, they'll find a way around it. But we're making it more difficult than just anybody coming in with anything. Mm-hmm. So it's not a perfect system, and there's always going to be theft. As long as metals are valuable, there'll be theft. But we do what we can to try to limit it as much as possible. And like I said, it peters off quite quickly when people go into an elevator and realize there's nothing they can get without bringing in machinery or stuff like that. So.
Now, even though you just recently have been employed at Duchak as the operations manager, you worked there
for years.
For years,
yes.
So when did you start working there?
It was my first job when I started university. That was my very first summer job.
Okay, so how far? I would say
this would be, wow. yeah. Oof.
10 years?
I say that I've probably worked there in some way, shape, or form. Full-time, part-time, casual, during the winters when I'm in school. Probably this will be year 10.
Okay. And have there been any changes in even just the regulations you were talking about having to, have a record of who brings what in?
Mm-hmm.
Or safety issues, like when you started talking about transformers and things, I was thinking, what do transformers have that aren't so good? PCBs? Was that old stuff?
That was old stuff. Like ballasts have PCBs, the old ballasts and things like that have PCBs, but they aren't worth much. The transformers are usually just steel and copper winding, so copper windings on steel. They're not very... to the best of my knowledge, and again, I'm not certainly not an expert on it, but to the best of my knowledge, transformers are not environmentally unfriendly. Mm-hmm. They can just be very large and hard to move. So people try to cut the copper off them and bring in the copper windings, so to speak. If you've seen an electric motor and there's little copper windings in it, a transformer is a massive version of that. Sometimes the windings are aluminum, though. They're not worth much, so people are trying to get, score. In terms of regulation changes, not much. It's just that theft has become more and more of an issue over the years. Theft has become more widespread.
And why do you think that is the case?
Well, boy, that's probably a much larger underlying issue to everything from the abuse of narcotics and what narcotics causes in terms of the thirst for money and probably the inability to hold a job so that there's very little other options to get money. It could be demographics. That could be anything from the age of people that are here to the minorities or even majorities that are here. Various underlying socioeconomic factors have, I think, contributed to theft. And what's n not to be understated as well is that over the years, metal prices have gone up. It's become more valuable. And when it's 4 or 5 cents a pound, it's really not worth it. But when it's $1 or $2 a pound, people can do the math and figure out how easy it is to do that. So I think there's been a few trends here that have kind of led to that, not the least of which has been the increase in value of scrap as the world becomes more environmentally, you say environmentally aware of mining and its effects, the cost of mining on everything from, say, even mining crude oil to make a lot of these products and things like that. Recycling has become a much cooler and now feasible idea. And as the third world ramps up production, everything from China to India, the need for recyclable products continues to grow. Hence, supply and demand comes in. Metals become more, and people find more now. Guys that were sitting on stuff that they were sitting on for a long time, they decide to cash out.
Yeah, you watch the market.
Yes, we watch the market. We are directly tied to the market. Our prices change often weekly. Not by much, but I mean it does. And like right now, for instance, where steel, a ton of steel last year was $160. Right now, it's 100. That's quite a
Well,
significant
that is a
difference.
difference.
But when your gas used to be a dollar, whatever it was, and then it went down to that, we simply followed oil. Oil dragged down all other commodities because oil is a big indicator in the economy, right? So.
So I'd like to follow up on a couple of things that you said. And don't let me forget to ask what you do with the scrap
Okay.
once you've got it.
Yep.
But I'm interested in sort of the socioeconomic situation. And I don't know if it was a conversation that I had with you, that sort of led me to ask you to be interviewed for this project. But there seems to be sort of an undergroup,
Yes.
almost, and not just locally. Like it's
Yes.
almost people travel and they know and they move into these abandoned industrial buildings and then they,
Squatters.
Squatters. Is
I believe we
that
call them
something you're
squatters. Yep, we
familiar
call
with?
them squatters. They're people that live in these buildings. They take up residence in anything that is vacant and use it for whatever purpose they need. Often it's shelter, especially in a northern community like this where there is a lot of weather-dependent factors that can harm you if you're not careful. They're called squatters. I think they exist in almost every town. Certainly here because we have a large number of. Not a large number, but we have a lot of industrial buildings that are vacant, not the least of which are elevators. They're big, they're near water, they're not normally frequented by a lot of people, and they're in industrial zones, so it's not like there's 7 or 8 houses right next to an elevator. No one's complaining. These people like to remain under the radar. They don't want to be noticed or seen. So places like elevators can certainly be a site where these people can take up residence, and yeah, that's certainly a valid something that we see.
Do you have, like you mentioned, what did you call them? Peddlers.
Yep.
Do they change regularly, or are some of them really long-term
Well, a lot of
customers
them are long
too?
term. The only time they really change is when they get nabbed. Then all of a sudden you don't see them anymore. And they were there, they were there, they were there, they were there, and then all of a sudden they're gone. And that normally means that they got held up by the authorities and probably couldn't provide the right answers or were caught in the act, which often is the case. And so we do have some that have been quite long term, and we often get the ones that just start and stop, start. And there's a million different reasons why. On someone who shouldn't be taken from an elevator stops taking from an elevator, the supply dries up, what's there? They get caught by the authorities, they end up succumbing to perhaps an addiction or something else that doesn't allow them to do that anymore. they move on, they're nabbed by somebody else. Often when you have no money, you're wanted by others for money that you couldn't pay. There's a host of reasons why we don't see these people anymore, and that's okay, because yeah. oftentimes they do bring unnecessary attention to our business. You know, the police will visit if there is something that's reported. They'll have to do a report. It takes away our guys as we have to go through the report process, go through the cameras, try to figure out who it was, find out at the end that there's nothing they can do, all for a few pounds of this or that. The police often don't like to do it. We don't like to do it. And as long as people keep coming in, we have actually gone so far as to ban certain people. We simply won't buy for them. And if we hope that the other two or three scrap yards in the city also don't, they have nowhere to take their stuff. That's one way to stop a thief who's stealing material, is they have nowhere to sell it. Mm. That's useless if you can't sell it anywhere.
Now, in some instances, too, it's... and I don't know if it's an elevator, so maybe you can tell me.
Mm-hmm.
But like you often, you occasionally hear of situations where there have been big thefts.
Yes.
Of quite valuable
yes.
scrap material.
Yes.
Is that... I wouldn't think these peddlers that are
no, it's
have
usually
addiction problems are those people.
No, it's usually a concentrated effort by people who also need money, but they often get together. And the reason I know this is because Duchek Scrap Metal had a very serious theft a few years ago, one that required a vehicle equipment. They actually we have a slab on grade type of storage facility, and they went through the wall. It was an all-night adventure. It took 7 or 8 hours for it to completely be done. So these guys had scoped out everything. They knew where our materials were. They knew how to get to them. They knew where our boxes. They had to know against the wall on the other side where the boxes were, so they knew where to hit the wall. They went through the brick wall, cut a hole in a box of copper, and siphoned everything out through the box, through the wall, into a pickup truck, and out. They got away with the better part of almost 2,500 pounds of copper, bare bright, on the open market. At that time, we were getting about $4 a pound. It's almost $10,000 of copper that they got away with. They were caught. They were brought to justice. When you have something that's that large, it's a lot easier to get caught. A, if you're going to leave it in the city, they're going to give it to somebody else. You simply call the other scrapyards and say, be on the lookout for a massive amount of bear bright. These guys can't hold it forever. Most of them don't have storage facilities. They need the money. Sure enough, within a few days, you know, you saw 1,000 pounds of it come somewhere else, and boom, gone.
So, like, were they local criminals?
Yes, they were. Yes. Hmm. We do have criminals that do, like, they can get fairly technical and fairly sophisticated with how they go about stealing.
Hmm.
But that isn't to say that, I mean, it's not in any other city as well. I certainly don't want to put down Thunder Bay as being like, we're all about thieves. We just, as a scrapyard, we see it more than others would, because the end result comes to us.
Yeah.
You know, if someone's robbing a Max, we don't see anything of part of that. But if they're robbing a new residential property and cutting all the copper out of it before the thing's even built, we'll see it. It often comes to us. There's only two or three scrapyards here. So we tend to see a side of society that we wish we wouldn't. But, I mean, it's one of those things. You could probably talk to somebody who works at an establishment that sells beer or wine, and they say the same thing. They see the worst of the worst. More than I ever would, where I am. But it's just the clientele that we have. It regrettably, we are exposed to a side of the clientele that we wish we weren't. But it's a part of society. Again, it's spurned on by other things. The price of metals, addictions, homelessness, lack of work oftentimes. People resort to whatever they have to do to get by.
Mm-hmm.
And so, regrettably, we just look at it as something that we try to deal with as best we can, comply with all laws and regulations, and... yes, because of the number of elevators that have gone down, it's this side of this underbelly of scrap collecting and recycling has manifested itself in that industry, mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, one of the things that someone that I know is really treasures from the elevators that were built in the early 1900s are some of the electrical fixtures, like the glass, globes,
okay. Yeah.
and... and such. Do people bother with that at the scrapyard, or there's a different kind of market for that kind
of
thing?
I've seen aluminum fixtures coming off of lights, but I have not, like, they're usually quite thick cast. Like, they're not like they are now, and what you'd see in changeouts for fixtures. But the glass and stuff, regrettably, is usually all over the floors of the elevator. They don't really have too much of an eye for historical relevance. And in they go, and they're usually carrying whatever they can carry as a person. So anything that will not get them money is left behind, right down to if they'll pull wire out of the wall, they'll strip it on site and leave all of the casing and the cabling behind and just bring in the copper, because they can't carry any more than that, and they're not going to lug garbage around. So everything. I was into the Pool 3 elevator, and Doug and I came across what appeared to be a copper wire processing plant. A squatter wire processing plant. He had everything there from a bench to empty casings and X-Acto knives, whatever he needed to get the copper out of the insulated packaging that it was in. So they can get as elaborate as they can with the amount of tools that they've got. And there's nothing to say. And I know this because I've talked to some of these guys. They will take the first bits of money that they get, and they'll buy tools to go in and get more. They'll buy cutters. They'll buy whatever they need to get stuff off the wall and cut it. They'll buy tools. They fancy themselves as serial entrepreneurs, some of them. So, I mean, I can't really comment on their business plan or the viability of it, but they fancy themselves as quite the innovators sometimes. And so it's quite interesting to see. But, yes, not a lot of historical relevance, not a lot of tools and things of that nature. More along the lines of what we call the guts of the elevator, all the wiring and all of the behind-the-scenes stuff that powers the cool-looking stuff, right? We won't get the light fixtures, but we'll get all the wire that went to the light fixtures, and they'll cut it right at the fixture. A, because they can't get the fixture off the ceiling. B, they can't get up there. But if they can get the wire off and they can get it 60 feet further down and they can yank it down and pull it down, they can get that off. Mm. So it's...
So they work hard.
They work hard?
They work hard at what they do.
Oh, God, yes. I know how hard I work processing stuff with the best tools. To have no tools doing what they do, I'd lose my mind. I don't even know how they do it. It's harder work than what most people do at a job, and they get paid a lot less to do it. Much less than minimum wage when you consider what it takes to process it to get it to the spot they get it in. For them, anywhere from $50 to $80 a day is awesome. But that took them all night for $50. You know what I mean? So.
It must also be dangerous.
Oh, extremely dangerous. Elevators are not inherently built for safety if you're attempting to get stuff off of an elevator that shouldn't be taken off. Yes, these guys don't use the stairs most often. They'll use whatever they got to do to get to places that you normally wouldn't want to get to or need to get to. Very dangerous. And they are often not in a good state of mind. They're doing it in the middle of the night. They usually don't use bright spotlights because that kind of draws some attention to the elevator, especially one that isn't in working. So these guys are using flashlights in an elevator that they don't have blueprints for, that they have no idea how it works. It's old. There's kinks, quirks, and things that you should know about before you even go into it. Much as go into it like they do. Then they'll go off the beaten trail to get the stuff that's not easily accessible in the middle of the night with no tools. Certainly, you think of fall protection and things like that, and being rigged and hoisted, and there's nothing. It's inherently dangerous, and it's has resulted in fatalities that we know of. We know specifically of one peddler who went into one of the elevators and decided to scale one of the bin walls in an attempt to get some sort of wiring off of one of the bin walls. And made it all the way to the top of where he needed to go, but fell straight down. And I believe those elevator they're just concrete. And down he went, and that was it. We only heard this from his son, who was assisting him. It was a family thing. And down he went from the top to the bottom. And we only heard that he had passed because we hadn't seen him anymore. And the son let us know when he came in with something that, dad had been in an elevator and didn't make it out. So that is a very grave risk that these guys take. And again, anything for money. They don't have any other options right now.
So what would they do in that case?
I don't know.
Like, with the son, I mean, say, yes, I was in that elevator, my father died, or
I
just leave him there for somebody else to find?
It's
what?
Probably something that the son would have, taken the body away from the elevator, and that's it. There would have been no money for funerals or anything like that. I don't know how anything like emergency services would ever have been called. Again, you have to think of when these guys are doing it, where they're there. You know, it's not something where you can call the police to an elevator when this. I mean, you know, maybe you at that point you do because life matters more than what you're doing. But if the person passed, he fell a great distance. Apparently, he was most of the way up. I believe this was a pool three, and he was most of the way up one of the bins. That is a significant fall. I don't know how high those bins are, but certainly high enough to do damage to a person who was likely over the age of 50 in the middle of the
close
night.
Close to 100 feet, if not higher.
Yes, and he plummeted. There was, that was it. I don't know how he managed it, but I can imagine that in the middle of the night, being up where you shouldn't have been, it's probably not that difficult to go down. So down he went. And that's not a mutually exclusive event. It happens. It happens often. If it doesn't happen in terms of death, injuries, grave injuries, and those are another reason why sometimes you just won't see these guys anymore. You don't know where they ever went, and it's a sad story because they're not really there. They have no family; they just kind of disappear, and they're just those guys that are—they're there and then they're not. They don't have ID. They don't have a lot of different things. They got to get their friends to even allow them to get it sold. So you don't even really know this person that was actually doing it. If they don't have ID and they're using one of their friends, no one ever really knows who that actual person that was orchestrating it. No one knows who they were. They're just not there. Right?
Before we move on to talk about what happens to this stuff, because it's almost like, I think of it as like a heart transplant or a kidney transplant. You know, the kidney of one person goes on to another person. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking here of all these elevator parts, mm-hmm. and you know, the concrete would get smashed up and you know, end up as foundation for a new building. So
yes.
You know, just wondering where,
yes,
where the elevator's pieces end up going. But before moving on to that, any other stories about the people and the actual taking stuff up the elevators that we haven't covered that come
to mind? That's pretty much it. We've chatted a little bit about what causes people to do it and why they're doing it and who's doing it. And again, like I say, there's not one specific demographic. It's a mixture, young, old, both genders. We get both genders, literally. And it's widespread. And now I say widespread, it certainly is a... It's a minority of the population. I would say in terms of the population as a whole, this is a very small percentage of people, but they're grabbing whatever they can. They're doing it for the money. The elevators are accessible, and they are, in terms of what they're taking.
I'm surprised that you said that there were females doing this.
Yes.
Would they be mainly the fronts for the business? You think?
No, they're often on their own. They are on their own. It's you see them, and they're not with anybody ever. You know, or if they are, they're just with someone who's there just to cash it in on their behalf, to put in an ID, because they're always the constant if it's a different person, right? And I would say it certainly is a male-dominated agenda, but there are females. We've seen it both, and we've seen young and old, and it's kind of sad. It's very sad, but it's something that we live with. It's something that is there, and I can imagine if you get similar stories going to, say, a methadone clinic. You know, there's a side of that society that we wish didn't exist, but it does. They probably wish it didn't. The people that are in it wish it didn't exist, but it does. They're not sure how to get help. And so what they need to do is they need to feel whatever it is that they need to feel to move on, to keep going. And they look at scrap as a very viable way. It's a simple, not complicated way to do it. And like I say, big buildings with large systems that require, you know, you go into a house, what are you going to find, right? A little bit of wiring, bits of wiring, household wiring, but you're not going to get large three-conductor tech cable. You just don't have the power requirements that you'd have in, say, an elevator. There's just more value in those until you get above hand height, in which case it's almost impossible to access this stuff. So hence the tales of death and injury. It happens. Mm. Yes, it does.
Now, where does it go?
Well, we are a global company, and by that I mean we ship everywhere. We may not, we've loaded everything from stuff going to Southern Ontario to we've loaded sea containers going to China. We ship direct to China. We can ship to Southern Ontario where it meets bigger yards that collaborate and then send to China. It goes to smelters that are here in Canada. For instance, the steel often goes to Sault Ste. Marie, which is SR Steel. It's melted down and made into rebar or a plate or structural beams. So the materials that would come out of an elevator are coppers, are brasses, are aluminums, are transported throughout Canada to different buyers in different provinces. It's transported into the US. It's also transported overseas at some points in times.
When it is transported by all, like by train, car, ship.
For us, because we do not have rail access, for us as Duchuk Scrap Metal at this time, we transport everything except for our steel via road. We load transport trailers, 53-foot trailers, and then they are shipped to different markets. Part of that is due to the fact that we don't have rail access. The other part is because we are so isolated. Oftentimes in larger communities, the smelter, the place that's making the materials, is not more than half an hour away from the scrapyard. In this case, our closest smelter is 7 hours away in Sault Ste. Marie. We often have to package it and send it down to Southern Ontario where it gets larger yards. They get massive amounts of it, and then it goes to other parts of the country or the world. So for us, trucking is our primary way of transporting. When it comes to steel, and we do get steel from the elevators, we will barge it. We put it on a barge and we float it down to Sault Ste. Marie, right along Lake Superior. We did our first barge last year. It was a success. We'll probably do another one. Prior to that, we trucked it to Sault Ste. Marie or sold it to a shredder that we have here in the city. We do have one shredder. And that shredder then puts it on rail cars and ships it to their steel yard. So.
The barge
Yes.
doesn't power itself, so
It has a
what's
tugboat.
it attached to? Oh, a
It's got
tugboat,
a
okay.
tugboat, and I took videos of it happening. It was pretty cool to see. Yes, the little tugboat powers this barge. It has 85. Well, there's the barge itself, and it has 8,500 tons of steel on it, which is 17.5 million pounds. And what it looks like once it gets out in the water is just one big blob, a big blob of steel, which is pretty much what it is. The barge is all steel, and there's steel on top of it. And this little boat, when they said with the barge, the only things they were worried about was calm waters. You can't really have a lot of issues. They have issues with large waves as a barge. I guess it's not built for doing what a Laker or a Salty would. So they have to wait for calm waters. They come in, they load, they float it down to Sioux, they unload, and that's their job.
And is it a barge out of the Sioux?
It's a barge company that barges anything. So they barge steel to the Sioux for us, but I believe they work in the Great Lakes. I don't know if they work in all of the different lakes, or maybe just Lake Superior and the one next to it. I'm not sure. This is their job. They just barge materials, whether it's rock, concrete, steel, whatever the ships aren't taking, they're barging. All different types of things. So it would be a neat thing to do.
Yeah.
You see a lot of cool stuff, I would assume.
So there's life in the elevator stuff. It goes and
It
it
goes.
becomes something else somewhere.
Yeah,
Sorry.
the steel often becomes the reinforcing beams and plates and stuff that would go into new buildings. The copper and stuff like that, the brasses are melted down to make new copper and brasses. So something from P&H could be ultimately melted down and could power a home in Canada through, say, BX cable or Smalltech. Brasses, same thing. It could be somebody's faucet, literally, somebody's faucet in a bathroom. If they're still made of brass. If not, then they're making other brass components. A lot of stuff, a lot of the brasses as household components become more plastics and different types of materials. We find a lot of the brass and copper still mainly only being used by the large utility companies like Hydro and stuff like that. So you might say that the infrastructure from the elevator is going back into our infrastructure, our transformers, our insulators that are sitting on hydro poles, that kind of stuff, where brass is still needed a lot. And steel, it's in the cars. Generally in our cars and our appliances. And
Do you think that if we look at how the system works, so we have these elevators that got built, long time ago.
Yes.
And then they are mostly abandoned.
Yes.
And some were deliberately taken down, like imploded or smashed to bits.
Yes.
Is it an efficient system of
well,
having them disappear or having them go out of existence? Is it efficient? Can you think of any of better ways of doing it
than simply having them vanish? Obviously,
vanish, or you know, like, does it make a difference if a group like Jim's
Global, yeah.
Does it make a difference if he ends up dealing with the abandoned elevator versus someone like, I think Jim Black was sort of notorious for buying up old elevators and getting whatever value he could out of them.
That's the way it's been going now, because there's value in the scrap, and then the, you know, a lot of an elevator is just concrete, so it just becomes fill, or it's ground up and sold and used as ingredients into new concrete or things like that. So for now, people seem to be finding that the components of an elevator, it's ferrous, non-ferrous metals, and then it's concrete and rebar, are more valuable than either taking the elevator and creating a second life for it. I know that with Global Recycling, Jim has looked into alternate uses for the elevator, various different things, and we've often heard of the major ones, right? Biomass and all this other kind of stuff, a pellet plant and all this stuff. But in the end, he's finding that it's, he found that he thinks it's going to be better off to try to sell the ingredients that built that elevator than as opposed to take the elevator in its current state built and utilize it. For instance, the dock is in bad shape at P&H, so the deepwater dock is valuable, but perhaps not for offloading grain. It might be more valuable as a cargo offloading or usage of something, building even space for people to live. He's looking at the land and the ingredients of the elevator as being more valuable than the elevator in its current state. Again, that elevator is an older one as well, so it does have some structural deficiencies, according to the electrician I spoke with, and would be very, very difficult to repair. To the best of my knowledge, having spoke to that electrician, he had said that they wanted to repair that elevator, but they could not get a reduction on their taxes, and hence the reason that they decided not to repair that elevator and simply move the stuff to cargo and kind of go from there. And the taxes are significant on those buildings. Yeah. So I'd love to see these elevators recommissioned to do other things. It just so happens that with the way our economy is going and the emergence of some of the industries that are taking hold to replace grain, to replace logging, don't require those types of structures, healthcare, things like that. They need their own structures. Mining has often one that's been linked to something that might need some components of an elevator for offloading material across water bodies to other sources. But because of the stuff that's been on hold there, and again, specialized stuff needed to offload ore, coal, whatever, right? So people have been finding that these elevators, what they do is they'd rather reuse the space for something that would be a little bit more what's in demand now.
Yeah, and it was built as a single use, very efficient.
That's the thing. It was built as a great thing for getting grain cleaned and loaded, but unless we're cleaning grain and loading it, no one can really figure out what else to do with large bins that are open spaces, right? It works great for what it's being used for, but that's one thing about this industry is if it changes or if things change with how it's done, there's usually a lot of access stuff that's just left, a lot of space, you know, so yeah. It's an interesting concept. Is it efficient? I don't know.
Now, I was in P&H after they shut it down.
Okay.
And it's amazing to me just how quickly something can look derelict.
Yes.
And the machines, as you had said, have probably been cannibalized.
Yes.
taking what was useful for the company.
Yes.
But there's a lot of machinery still left in there, not workable machinery. So do they, like, do people go in with blowtorches and...
Yes. They'll cut it all apart. They have to get it out. So they'll go in there with torches. They'll cut it up, take it out. They often will use machines if they can as well. Shears, excavators, and they'll often engage in demolition in that nature as well. So oftentimes if it can't be done with manpower, it'll be done with machines, but that means access for these machines. They got to get into the space to be able to grab the machines, grab the steel, load it onto trucks, and then it obviously ends up at something like our place. And Global Recycling is supposed to be giving Duchek Scrap Metal all the scrap from that P&H elevator, so it'll be interesting to see what comes in. This would be the first time that an elevator from start to finish, as Jim tries to recover all of the metals out of it. What else would come out? I mean, we've already seen some tech cable and some higher valuables, but I haven't really seen much in terms of machines, like you said, or things like that. And again, with P&H, I've spoken about it. I haven't been in there since it was shut down, so I don't know what's left. I know that a lot of the valuables are gone, but the electrician said valuables from a standpoint of, like, this stuff still works. It doesn't mean it's necessarily costly, and there's probably a lot of infrastructure still in that elevator. Yeah, so like I said, it's there's a lot of stuff in there, and it'll either be machine taken out or person taken out or a mixture of both, right? So it'll be an interesting thing to like I say, they're directly right beside us, so
mm-hmm. Yeah, convenient.
Convenient, yes.
So let me just check my questions here.
Okay.
This is a weird question and may not even have an answer, so mm-hmm. I'll ask it. I'll ask it anyway.
Okay.
But one of the questions that we do ask of the people who are in the grain industry more directly than the work you do is:
yeah.
How do they feel that the work that they do contributes to Canada's success as a grain trader?
Mm-hmm.
So it requires a little bit more. Imagination on your part to answer that question. Like, how would you say that what you do contributes to Canada's economic success as a grain trader? Is there any connection?
Well, for us, I mean, regrettably, it's the elevators coming down. It's them stopping existence and coming down that allows us to get what we've got to do and kind of go from there. I guess the only lopsided connection I could make is that as we're taking down these older elevators, it comes as a result of collaboration between a lot of the grain companies. So you may not have a P&H elevator there, but Cargill gets a little bit stronger. They have more equipment. They have more staff. They have more people. AgriCorps S House is not there, but Vitura apparently bought them and told them they couldn't put grain anymore out. So now Vitura gets a lot to its elevator. So maybe by taking down these older elevators, maybe a lot would have died when it was all parted out to different companies. And as they conglomerate, the companies that remain, Richardson's, Vitura, are stronger, better for Canada's grain trade, more efficient. They're getting more volume. And I'd rather see a few elevators go down than all of them go down. And if P&H going down, because it's 100 years old, there's so much history to it, it's such a neat elevator. But if it going down means that cargo keeps going, so be it. If AgriCorps going down, I think the AgriCorps elevator is a beautiful elevator. If it goes down, but it means that one of the larger ones in Canada continues to run and gets all it needs to keep working, so be it. Whatever the market takes to be efficient, and I don't think there's quite the volume going through that there used to be, though we had a good year. Collaboration there's going to be excess from this collaboration. But at the very least, because these guys are conglomerating and being, you know, they're becoming larger entities, we'll still have some, and we're represented in Thunder Bay by some of the biggest companies, mm-hmm. and that's cool. So,
and I guess just the fact that you're saying that it's recycling,
yes,
makes the fact that is it fair to say that the service you provide ends up with less waste?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
So that there is some value in the elevators.
Yes.
So somebody will.
Well, what you have is because there's value in the elevators, a demolition company will buy them. It would be really terrible if every company that was in an elevator knew that once they were done operating that elevator, nobody was going to buy it and they were going to have to pay taxes because even the city would never take it back. The companies at least know that, yes, these are single-use facilities. When we're done with it, it'll probably won't be used for anything else. But at least there is some residual value, and that requires a demolition company to take an interest and buy it, which allows it to be taken down, which allows the city to reuse that land, which means that if ever there was another elevator built, the city wouldn't say no, because they know that there'll be something at the end of that to allow it to go back to the way it was instead of having something that stays there forever and nobody wants to touch it, ever.
And,
right?
and you provide the market.
We provide the market for the scrap, which is the primary value of a derelict elevator. It is the scrap. It is not the concrete. The concrete is used as fill, and that's great. But there will be more scrap value in an elevator than there will be any other ingredient other than the land. The land is obviously the biggest value an elevator has. It takes large swaths of land, often great access to water, deep water ports, which are awesome as well. But from an elevator standpoint itself, the building itself, the scrap materials that come out of it is what most demolition companies are buying out. That's what they're buying it for. That or the value of the machinery. But in the cases of a lot of these older elevators, the machinery isn't worth anything either. It's not. It's already been taken out by the company that was there before. So they're in there to get what they can out of it, and that's their specialty. They would not buy that elevator if they had nowhere to sell that stuff. They wouldn't. They just wouldn't. So we provide that outlet, which, if in some weird, small way, contributes to collaboration and a company leaving an elevator knowing that it can get rid of the elevator so it can move to this part here, then I guess in some small way you could say we're connected.
And the final question, do some historical artifacts ever make their way across your...
Well, like I said, I've seen like a grain shovel, which I thought was kind of neat. I didn't keep it, regrettably, but it was around, and I thought I saw it, and then it was gone. And we don't get a lot of, again, we don't get a lot of fixtures. It seems to be the actual just wiring, and it seems to, I mean, if this will be the first time where a full elevator is demolished, according to Global Recycling, and they say they're going to bring everything that's of any value in it whatsoever to us. We might see something. I don't know how this stuff will come in. I mean, right now we're getting New Tech Metals is giving us all of the old piping off of Vitura, because Vitura is switching out a lot of their blowers on top of their elevators right now. Mm-hmm. Something along those lines. You see, I don't know how familiar with Vitura Terminal A, you're probably quite familiar. There's all those big blue silos up at the top hanging off the elevator. Mm-hmm. They're swapping some of those out. So there's capital investment happening at Vitura's Terminal A, which is always good. Capital investment is good. We're getting all of the scrap. But again, it's basically galvanized piping. There's really nothing of significance to it other than that it's piping. We got some big funnel-type things that came from Vitura, but I don't know how old they looked. They looked quite old. But they looked like they would have been on the top of the elevators, kind of those half-hopper type things, and they looked like those were the old ones off the top of the elevators, and they were putting up the new ones, so we got those in. But they were just thin steel, full of grain dust inside, and just older stuff like that. So it's happening. We're seeing stuff, but I think we might get some artifacts with the P&H one.
Watch for those nice glass globe light fixtures.
Glass globe light fixtures. I will watch, because that's something that they may have. If they take them down,
they do. I saw them, but yes. They're way up there.
So oh, you
I,
saw
and,
them.
And actually, Jim let me go in and said, you know, okay. Is there anything that you want here? But I thought, I wouldn't mind having those light fixtures, because apparently there's a market for them. Plus, we thought that we might be able to use them if we ever get a center going.
Right.
But from a value perspective, just as a fundraiser. So.
But they were up.
Yeah, where light fixtures are in elevators.
Yeah, unreachable by most, right? So
that's right.
It'll depend on how he proceeds with demolition.
Yes, exactly.
In terms of if he can salvage them. So.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting.
You never know.
Yeah, I should ask him to take some photographs as they do it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we'll certainly see a lot from where we are as well. We're right there.
Yeah.
So it's pretty neat.
Well, thank you very much.
I didn't think
it would be an hour, but it has been an hour, and it's been very informative and a slant on elevators down that no other person has been able to provide us. So thank you very much.
Not a problem. Thank you.